welcome back to the Inspiration Space for yet another fantastic episode. I know I always say it, but this really is a really fantastic episode. It's another example of why I'm so grateful and happy to have this podcast, because I get to meet amazing, amazing people like this. I spoke to Michael Maisie yesterday. If you don't know who Michael Maisie is, you're in for a real, real delight. I mean, this is a fantastic, fantastic story, more than anything, of redemption, I would say. I think that's probably the best way to describe it in a way. Michael grew up in an environment which sort of breeded crime, and the future for him from the start really didn't look bright. I'm not going to tell the story here because he tells it best himself, and obviously in his book, which comes out on July the 11th, so this week. He's given me a copy which I cannot wait to read, and this episode he talks of his journey and how he had to fight loads of obstacles to get to where he is. At the age of 25, Michael had been through in and out of jail and young offenders institutions, several times. He bounced back into a society which kind of didn't give him a lot of opportunity. So he had to really change himself more than anything to get to where he wanted to be. Now Michael is a mentor for young offenders in these institutions. He's a business coach. He has several businesses of his own. He has a family. He has tons of amazing, amazing things going on in his life. And more than anything, this is a story that doesn't matter what circumstance you are in, you are always able to change the outcome and the direction of your life. And that is a really, really important message. If Michael can do it, as you'll hear from his story and hopefully read from his book, you can always, always change what is going on in your life and the direction it's going in. So more than anything, that is kind of what this podcast theme is all about. You know, the Inspiration Space, that's what it's about. It's about the fact that you are in control, you can change elements, and there's hope, essentially, at the end of the tunnel. So guys, really get stuck into this episode. It is unbelievable. Yeah, like I said, definitely get Michael's book. I will leave it in the show notes, but it is called Young Offender, and it is out on the 11th of July. So yeah, please, please go and buy it. It is an outstanding story. Have a fantastic day, guys, and get stuck into this episode. So first things first, mate, thank you so much.
No worries.
For coming down. I know it's a massive time for you. Your book's being released on July the 11th, which is like a week time.
Yeah, this time next week. Yeah,
fantastic.
Week away.
Fantastic. Like when Ollie told me, you know, that he'd met you, and I did my little bit of research and what he told me on you, I was gagging to get you down. So thanks so much. Really, really appreciate it.
No worries. I think
probably would be best. What this episode really will be is you kind of telling us your story a little bit, kind of what you've learned, and like where you're going now.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think give yourself a little bit of a background, mm-hmm. so the listeners know like a bit of context around mm-hmm. who you are.
Yeah, sure. So my name's Michael Maisie. I've written a book called Young Offender. It's a story about my life. I'm an actor, author, business coach, mentor, been sober for 11 years. Grew up in a single parent family. My father left before I was 1 year old. He was a drug addict. He still is an addict today, unfortunately. And my mum come from a Romani gypsy background, and basically raised me on her own. She was an alcoholic as well. So life was tough, basically. You know, I didn't really have much support from my two primary caregivers. I suffered physical abuse, sexual abuse growing up, and essentially like just made a decision really young that this world isn't a friendly place. You can't trust the people that are closest to you. The people that you love let you down, and basically just grew up as an angry young man, angry, confused, sad young man, you know. And got into a teenage years. I went through a period of bullying, and then I, you know, discovered alcohol, hanged out of a local gang, and then, you know, became addicted to that power and the violence, and then got arrested for armed robbery and possession of firearms when I was 15. So got heavily into crime at a very young age. Back then, there wasn't a lot of 15-year-old armed robbers. And pretty nuts, man. And it was like, that was my life, really. You know, I wasn't okay with being that scared little boy, because I didn't want to feel exposed or weak. So I had to be this sort of tough, scary guy. And, you know, it led me down, you know, a lot of wrong paths, you know, essentially prison. I spent most of my teenage years in that. I felt I'm young offenders. A lot of that is detailed in the book. And, yeah, I come out of prison when I was 18, went to my first AA meeting and didn't get sober 18, but I got sober when I was 25. And I've been sober ever since. And I've done loads of stuff in that 11 years since I've been sober. Self-development, going back into prisons, helping other young kids. Got an award for it in 2014, presented to me by the Chief Superintendent of the Metropolitan Police. That was pretty surreal, you know, coming from a guy who had a really terrible relationship with police, then getting presented with an award. Amazing, yeah. For the voluntary work I'd done. And then wrote the book. So, you know, that's a little bit about me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, a couple of things I want to touch on in regards to those sort of early years. I mean, anything I've listened to you whilst doing my research is that you talk about how much anger you had in mm-hmm. those early years during when you were going in and out of Feltham. Is it Feltham?
Feltham Young Offenders, yeah.
I mean, how many incidents were there that made you back in and out? Was it a couple of times?
I was in and out three times.
Three times?
Three times between the age of 16 and 18.
And at that time, you were in a gang culture the whole period?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I mean,
can you talk to us a little bit about what that sort of gang culture is like? I mean, is it the same now from your experience with young offenders now?
Yeah, I think so. I think basically the logistics of it and the structure of it is very similar. So you've got a community where a lot of the fathers are absent, or the fathers are around and they're involved in crime themselves, or they're violent to their mothers, the mother of their child. Or they're alcoholics and addicts themselves. So essentially you've got a community where there's very few role models, male role models, father figures, and the ones that are there aren't very good ones. So then the elders in the community take on that role. And as young men, it's built within us to feel like a sense of belonging, like we belong to something. And in the absence of a father figure to guide us through that process in selecting the right people that we want around us, we just fall into people who've come from similar backgrounds as us, you know, other kids who don't have dads, right? And so, you know, then it becomes like a hierarchy within that gang of, you know, where you fall in the scale of, you know, of in that hierarchy. And a lot of it depends on the things you're willing to do and the things you're not willing to do. And for me, it was like having experienced so much trauma as a kid, having experienced so much pain, there wasn't a lot that scared me, and there wasn't a lot I wasn't willing to do, because I'd already come through hell as a kid. And so when I meet a lot of the young kids, when I go into prisons now, I don't know the exact statistic, but the amount of guys that I meet, I would say it's like 90% of them either don't have their dad around, or their dad's in prison, or their dad was around but was a drug addict. And, you know, so the father figures / role models these boys have are other elders in the community who are lost young men as well.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of take for granted, you know, I've my father is my biggest hero, and I can totally imagine having that absence can throw you into that sort of environment. What interests me as well is the environment of Feltham. Like, I mean, what was that like? What was that like in those early years between, what was it, 15 you said, and 18?
Yeah.
I mean, could you give us a bit of background on what it was like as an environment? It must have been extremely, I don't even know what the word I would use to describe it.
Scary.
Scary.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Scary is basically what it was. Yeah. You know, I went into prison the first time for attempted murder. So I went onto the toughest wing in Feltham Young Offenders, which at that time was a wing called Quail. All the wings in Feltham Young Offenders are named
Quail.
Quail. All the wings are named after birds, different type of birds.
Yeah.
And Quail was like the murderer's wing, where all the tough, real tough guys go. And I was, you know, a young, pretty white boy. That's what I looked like. Yeah. Stood out like a sore thumb. There weren't many 16-year-olds on that wing, right? And, you know, I basically went in there with a silly mentality. My mentality was, you know, you don't have to win the fight. You just have to stand up for yourself. So it doesn't matter if you win. You just have to let people know they don't mess with you, right? Because back then it was like, on that wing, it was like 80% black, 20% white, a little mixture of Asian back then. And the white kids basically fell into one category. They got bullied and robbed for all their stuff. And the ones who didn't were the ones who stood up for themselves. Now, you didn't necessarily win the fights, but you just knew, okay, if you try and take something off me, I'm gonna punch you in your face. Yeah. And so, yeah, I went in with that mentality, and it details it in the book. You know, I was lucky to escape with my life, to get off that wing with my life.
How long were you there for?
I was about 6 months. 6 months. Yeah. And, you know...
And what was the mentality like waking up every day? Like that kind of that stuff would like fascinates me. Like,
was yeah.
it a struggle? Was it just a constant battle mentally?
It was just desperation,
right.
Really. And, you know, you imagine you go to university to get a qualification in something. This was like a qualification in crime. We were locked up for 23 hours a day in a cell with other criminals. And all we would talk about is the crime you committed and how you got caught. That was really it. And so I left prison the first time completely educated on all the crimes and how people got caught, and especially if someone was in there and it went to trial, because the police have to document all the evidence that came up, how they caught this person. And we're just exchanging notes in prison because you're locked up 23 hours a day. And so you leave almost like fully...
More knowledgeable.
More knowledgeable, yeah. And then you're released into a community where everyone else is struggling. No one else can get a job. I now can't get a job. And it almost like the world almost pushed me back into the life that I really didn't want to go back to.
That was actually my next question. I mean, after like 6 months of almost hell, could you say it was close to...
Yeah.
You imagine as hell?
Yeah, like, it was,
To be able to go then back inside, like to then come outside and do something to then put you back into a situation like that, it must have been just the environment that you went back into, that sort of gang culture. Like, but you know, is that what it was that drove you back in? Just
it
drove
was
you back into it.
Yeah, no. Honestly, it was desperation.
Yeah.
Like I came out, I tried to get a job. First question people asked is, "Where have you been the past 6 months?" And you know, I'd be honest. And they'd be like, okay, unfortunately, the job's not for you. You're not the right person. You get loads of them knockbacks. And then in the end, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go and join the army. And I thought, surely they'll let me in. Surely if I go and sign up to an infantry unit where they just put me on the front line with a gun, like, surely I'll be able to get into an infantry unit. And literally went to the careers office, told the careers officer what I'd been... I was honest. I thought it's pointless lying. It's all on my record anyway.
Yeah.
And I was honest and pretty much got laughed at the careers office. And they was like, it's not happening, son. You know, you're never going to get in. So, and I left there and I was just like, there's nothing I can do then. I can't get a job. I can't even serve in an infantry unit. Like, what am I meant to do? And it was like, I just have to go back to that way of life. That's all that's there for me now, you know. And so I went back and, you know, got back involved with crime, and you know, within a, you know, 2 or 3 months, I was back in Young Offenders again.
Wow.
You know, so I left prison really not wanting to go back there, but there wasn't many options. And I think it's changing a little bit now. I know there's a few more opportunities for young guys now, but I know for me back then, there wasn't really many.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that interests me. I was kind of going to ask that. I hope that there are more procedures in place. Probably having people like you involved now probably smooths that transition for any young offenders that are coming back out from prison. That's kind of part of your role is helping these guys get through it. But then on the outside, I suppose, who's in charge of that? Who can help these guys into a better way of life?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's some things in place now, but with all the cuts, sort of probation and stuff has become like a sort of box ticking exercise, really.
Yeah.
I think more needs to be done, and I think you're right in saying like people like myself need to come forward who've been through it, who've turned their lives around, and just sort of just be like a light to guide others to the same process. But I think it's hard, you know. A lot needs to change, because even just the fact where these kids are coming out of prison and just being put back in a community where everyone is struggling, and you're somehow expecting them to have a miraculous transformation when they're surrounded by everyone else who's struggling. You know, we are the company we keep. You know, if you're surrounded by a load of people who are struggling, the odds are you're going to end up, you know, so.
So true.
I think, you know, even with someone like me right by their side, guiding them all the way, if 90% of their time is spent in a community where everyone's selling drugs, they're probably going to go back to a life of crime eventually, you know, unless you get some unique individuals who have a real determination to change. So
yeah. So 18 comes around and you're now out of Feltham for good. You talk about your first AA meeting mm-hmm. at the age of 18.
Mm-hmm.
So with all this going on, like you're in Feltham,
mm-hmm.
you were using drugs in Feltham and drinking in Feltham, or could you give us a bit of background mm-hmm. on that?
Yeah, so you could get drugs in Feltham,
yeah.
But you couldn't get alcohol unless right. it was homemade stuff, which was terrible. But never really drank alcohol. I smoked a bit of weed when I was in Feltham Young Offenders, mm-hmm. but never done anything hard. But you know, I came out of prison when I was 18, went to my first AA meeting. The big change that happened for me in my last time in prison was that my mum got sober. So my mum had been an alcoholic all my life, and then she got sober on my last stint inside, and I promised to her when I came out of prison I'd go to an AA meeting, and that was it. You know, I went there, I could relate to what people were saying, I identified with what they were saying, but my perception of someone with a drink problem was someone who either slept on a park bench or woke up in the morning and drank like every day. And I never drank every day. I was just a binge drinker. So I sort of justified my reasons why I didn't fit in there, why I didn't belong, and spent the age of 18 to 25 like really trying to figure out, okay, am I an alcoholic? Do I have a problem with drink? Can I drink normally? And, you know, I tried not drinking Stella, only drinking Foster's, or not drinking Foster's, only drinking Guinness, and not drinking any stuff like that, just drinking vodka, and not drinking vodka, drinking whiskey. And trying all these different things, thinking, oh, I'm not going to hang around with him, and I'm not going to drink that. And then in the end, just getting to age 25 and being like, yeah, I just got a problem with alcohol. Mm. Whenever I take anything into my system, it changes me to a point that becomes problematic in my life. And I just became sick and tired of sort of just scraping by. Do you know what I mean? Never having really big dreams and aspirations and never really getting anywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Not reaching your full potential of what you knew you were capable of.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was like, alcohol was number one hindrance.
It was, yeah. Well, as soon as things got hard, and not even when things got hard, as soon as I felt any level of emotion, I just went and drank. So if I had done really well at work, I would go to the pub and celebrate. So I'd check out, right? When really I should have been going, okay, what did I do well? How do I replicate that so I can do the same again every week? But also, if I had done bad, or if I got the sack, which happened a lot to me because I was always, you know, a nightmare, I would then go to the pub and drown my sorrows instead of evaluating what did I do wrong so I don't make the same mistake again. So that it left no room for growth. I never evaluated and looked overall at my life and my performance in all areas. And, you know, I think that was the big hindrance to me growing emotionally and mentally as a human being, was that when things got hard, or even when things got good, mainly Friday nights and Saturday nights, I'd be in the pub or the bar or the nightclub. You know,
it's funny though, I like the amount of people in this society where that is probably the case, like,
yeah, right,
without that relationship with alcohol and drugs is madness. Like, yeah, this whole, it's almost like society placing on us like that whole Monday to Friday, like, thank fuck it's Friday, or whatever.
Yeah, it's culture.
It's culture, and it's something that, I mean, look, I still go out and I do have a laugh with my mates and all that kind of stuff, but nowhere near as much as it was. Like, it's not like a protocol now. Like, I'll go and have drinks, a couple of drinks with my friend, if, you know, just on the social side of things. But I remember the days when it was Friday and like all my mates were like, oh my God, it's Friday. Let's go and just write ourselves off. And like, whether you had a good week or a bad week, like you just said, like, it's just, it was like a thing to go to, just to kind of, I don't know, just cultural things to go to. So yeah, that's a really interesting point. I think what I'm interested on is in that 18 to 25 gap.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you obviously, you had lots of ups and downs in that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and it wasn't until you sort of got yourself sober that you started working with in these institutions.
In prisons, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah, so basically that was it. I mean, 18 to 25 was really trying to prove to myself that I didn't have a problem with alcohol, and then eventually just throwing the towel in. You know, like, I just couldn't do it.
What was
normally
the moment you decided to do that?
Well, it was funny, there was a series of moments. So, you know, there was one moment where I came back to London and it was my birthday weekend. It was my 25th birthday weekend, and my mum and my brother had organised this weekend for me. And anyway, I ended up messing it all up and causing mayhem. And I remember looking at my brother's face. He was 13 at the time. And I was like the apple of his eye at that time. You know, he really looked up to me. And I'd just gone on a bender from Friday to Sunday, like just out of my mates, and I'd used cocaine to keep the party going. And I come back on the Sunday, I see his face really upset. And I was like, that wasn't part of the weekend that I planned. I didn't want that bit of the weekend. But I knew when I had that first few drinks on the Friday, it was probably going to end up that way. And it was like this moment where I was like, I don't think I fully have control over this. I think once I have 2, 3, 4 drinks, I think I could end up anywhere. Do you know what I mean? I don't really know when the night's going to end.
Yeah.
And so I was like, yeah, I don't want to do that to my brother. And so that was it. It was like, it was that moment, and then having a commitment to getting sober. And then I relapsed another 2 times, you know, and then eventually in the December, enough was enough. I was like, yeah, I just can't do this anymore, you know.
And what was the main things in your mindsets that shifted?
Yeah, it was really just emotional pain. Mm. So, you know, I relapsed once. So after that incident with my brother, I went 3 months sober. Then I went to Jamaica for a family wedding. Relapsed in Jamaica, caused mayhem, felt loads of pain. I was like, I'm not doing that again. And then it come to the Christmas party in December, relapsed again, and I just was so angry and upset with myself. I was like, that is it now. I'm so done with this. And I also lost my job. You know, I ended up getting the managing director of the company I worked for in a headlock, trying to choke him out. In complete blackout, I was just, you know, so drunk I couldn't even remember doing it. And it was just that, really. It was the pain of just being like, God, I'm so sick to death of this bloody way of life. I just can't do it anymore. And then reaching out for help, you know, just someone put his hand out to me and said, let me help you. And, you know, in AA, they have the 12-step program. And he said, I want to take you through the first 3 steps of the 12-step program so you can understand what you're suffering from and you can get, like, some help. And, you know, touch wood, I've never drank alcohol or took any drugs since that day, since he put his hand out to help me. So that's what, you know, my thing now is like, can I be that person to someone else who puts his hand out and changes the direction that person's life is going in?
That's amazing. That's so amazing. I mean, like, from that moment, did it, like, obviously there was a process of kind of getting your head clear and sort of refocusing yourself, I would have imagined. Mm-hmm. What kind of then set you off onto the path of working in institutions and sort of, like you just said, helping people steer clear of almost the direction you went down?
Mm. Yeah, so the way it works, when you go to an AA meeting, you get a chance to talk. And it took me a long time to open up in front of a group of people. Mm. But once I did, people were fascinated that I'd had the life I'd had, that I'd done all this crazy stuff, right? And that I turned it around, and that, you know, back then there weren't many like 25-year-old sober men who'd had a life like mine. And so a lot of people were like, you'd be great to talk to the young kids in prison, because they hold like AA meetings in prisons all over the place. Sure. And a couple of people were like, I need
to relate to.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah. And they were like, oh, I need to get you in to talk to these guys in prison, mate, if they could just hear you. And so that was it. I went and done, you know, my first talk back in Fair Young Offenders, which went really well. And then someone else heard about it. And before I knew it, I was going to all the prisons all over around London and Surrey. And that's sort of how I got into it, was through that. Yeah.
Amazing. And like, now, are you still doing it to this day?
Yeah, I still do it now. Yeah.
Is it like a program you do, or is it just simply going and speaking and then mentoring? Or?
Yeah. So it's quite difficult with, when you're going into prisons and you're trying to, you can't really bring in some new type of program, because it all has to go through some security and vetting system, you know. So what I do is I literally just go in off the cuff and I just talk about my life, talk about my experiences, and whatever comes up with certain men at the time, I try and help them explore that, you know, so I can, you know, give them a bit of sort of advice, basically. Yeah.
Amazing. I'd love to come and see like one of these talks you do. I mean, like, yeah. Is there like literally a group of young offenders you're going to speak to?
Yeah. And not just young offenders, like I go to adult prisons as well. And right. So it would just be like, you know, a group full of men that you know are in prison who have expressed an interest to, you know, change and hear a story like mine. And so a lot of the time, you know, guys are just there to, they just want some time out of their cell. They're just sick of being locked up, right? Yeah, so they're not really interested. But when they hear me talk, everyone's ears pricks up because, you know, they want to hear from people who've been through it. It gives them hope. They're like, oh, well, this guy's actually been where I've been and he's here now. And I think the fact that I'm quite young as well inspires them because they're like, this guy's actually relatable. He's a similar age to me. And if he's done it, then maybe I can do it. So yeah.
What's the like main, I mean, obviously everybody's situation is slightly different in prison. You've got loads of people in there for different circumstances. What's the kind of underlying message that you, is it hope? There's always hope. There's always a way to change a situation. Is that kind of it?
Well, it's just that change is possible. Yeah. You know, like a lot of guys, when you go into prison, their dads are in prison. Their dad's dads are in prison. All their mates are in prison. So it's just like, it's like a cultural thing in their community and it's been around for generations. You know, like similar to how you meet some guys and they're in the army and their dad was in the army and their dad was in the army, yeah? Mm-hmm. You get the same in these communities. It's like going to prison, being locked up. It's like, it's a historical thing, yeah? Mm-hmm. And so here I am coming in where I'm saying, yeah, all my mum's side of the family, their men were in prison. My father was in prison. His father was in prison, yeah. Loads of kids from my community was in prison, but I'm not in prison and I've been sober 11 years and I've changed my life.
Yeah.
So if I can, then why can't you? Mm. Oh, but this happened and this happened. Yeah, but this happened to me and this happened to me. Did this happen to you? No, it didn't. Oh, well, what's your excuse then? And it sort of, what I find is a lot of guys make up these excuses in their mind. Oh, you don't get it, what it's like for me, man. This happened to me. And then they hear my story and they're like, oh, shit, yeah, mine weren't as bad as that.
It's like a self-limiting belief that you kind of set upon yourself through the experiences you've had in your life almost. It's like, because that has happened, I'm restricted on doing X, Y, Z.
Mm,
like
yeah.
Getting people to, how do you kind of break people down into getting to realize? Is it simply, your story probably is the starting point.
Yeah, that's it really, you know, because, yeah. You know, the self-belief is like, it's broken up into two things, you know, like the self is you and what you believe in and what is it you believe in essentially? What will make me happy? And so you look around your community and you might, on a scale of 1 to 10, look at someone who is the most successful and who is the least successful. So in our communities, like for instance, my community, the most successful guy was a guy who was a postman. He had 2 daughters and he had a nice life. Yeah, he went to work. And then you had the middle rank, people who didn't really have a job but weren't crack or heroin addicts. And then you had the ones at the bottom who were the crackheads. And so in my head, I thought, I could probably be a postman one day. And so my self-belief was based on that chart, a 1 to 10, right? Yeah. And then you go out into the world and you realize, actually, the postman's like about a number 3. Yeah. And actually, a number 10 is way out of reach for me. And with that, your self-belief plummets. And then you hang around with other kids who also have low self-belief. And, you know, it's like you're going in and you're trying to break this thing of like, okay, what you view as a number 10 of someone who's, you know, got the car, got the house and all that as happiness, actually it isn't happiness because I've achieved all that in my life and it doesn't bring you happiness. Let me tell you, Sam, the happiness is the postman and his simple life that he provides for his family and, you know, he's being there for his kids. That's where the happiness is. And when you say that, it's like, oh my God, that's achievable, actually. I can do that. I can, even if all I'm doing is being there for my kids, I can do that, you know?
Yeah.
And I think the low self-belief and the limiting self-belief comes from, you know, believing that you have to achieve something really big to experience happiness right now. And that's just not the case. In my experience, that's not the case.
No, for sure. I mean, I've had a couple of clinical psychologists on here, and it's, I mean, you know, success has to be completely unique to you and you have to really like think about it. You can't forge your idea of success on what society shows all over Instagram or whatever. It's completely unique to you and like everybody's definition of success should be something different. That's such a good analogy, that the postman.
Yeah, yeah, right.
It's really good.
It sticks in your head, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, I like it. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, it's funny, like I'm kind of going on my own personal business journey now. I mean, you know, we've got one gym here and I truly am happy because like the members aren't my children, but you know, I know everybody's names.
Yeah.
You know, but at the beginning I thought, oh, I want to have 50.
Yeah.
You know, but will that necessarily mean happiness? Yeah, it may mean more money, but the quality, you know, the part of the job that I love, which is interacting with the members and doing the day to day here, you know,
yeah,
who knows?
I mean, it won't.
Who knows, you know?
Yeah, well, my experience is it doesn't. You know, quality over quantity. So yeah, if you have one and the quality of service you provide to your members is great, then it's better than having 10 and the quality of service you provide to your members is pretty crap.
Yeah.
And then it gets a bad reputation. So, you know, I had the same thing. I set up a business and, you know, someone sat down with me and was like, you know, oh, you should open up 2 or 3 or 4. And I was like, and then what? And he's like, well, you know, you'll have loads of money in your bank and you'll be able to, you know, sit back and relax and enjoy. And I'm like, yeah, my two kids will probably be, you know, 18 then, you know, and I would have missed them growing up. And he's like, yeah, but, you know, you look at the life you can provide for them. I'm like, I can provide a good life for them now and I can still watch them grow up. I was like, what's the one asset we can't buy?
Time.
We can't buy time. I was like, you know, and I remember I spent time with my father-in-law, who was, he got quite ill about sort of 4 or 5 years ago. I remember sat with him and I said, looking back at everything, would you change anything? And his answer was, he said, the one thing I wish I had done was worked less and spent more time with, he's got two daughters as well, one of them's my wife, saying, I wish I had spent more time, worked less and spent more time watching them grow up. He's like, because all the money you earn can never buy that time back. And I remember like, seeing this guy who was like in his 60s with a look of regret in his face, and I was like in the middle of really pushing hard on my business, and I was like,
I don't want that, man.
Yeah. I don't want that. So, you know, and ironically, you know, I took a step back from the business and spent loads of time with my kids like I do now, and the business has just carried on growing anyway. So
that's another story in itself.
So like, yeah, you know, so yeah, it's just interesting how it works.
It is. It seriously is. I mean, that was kind of what I wanted to go on to next. So you obviously you start working in these institutions, having a real impact, and something that I'm sure is unbelievably fulfilling.
Mm-hmm.
And then you went and stepped into the business world and mm-hmm. made a real success. I mean, mm-hmm. what was your kind? Here's a question that I wrote down.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the main components? I kind of got an idea in my mind what your answer would be. But what are the couple of the main components that you knew that you had to change in order to stop relapsing and then kind of move in the direction to reach your full potential that you kind of mentioned earlier?
Yeah. Yeah. So look, it's basically look in the mirror.
Mm.
You're looking at the problem. Mm. Stop pointing the finger.
Mm.
If you want to grow and you want to learn anything in life, you know, especially if you own your own business, yeah, the buck stops with you. You're the boss. So don't blame your staff, you know, don't blame the staff that you recruited. Don't blame this or that or, you know, the market or whatever. Take accountability, go away and look at yourself and work on yourself. You know what I mean? The world, your reality, what you experience is just a reflection of what's going on inside you. So if you haven't got the life you want, that's a reflection of what you believe about yourself. Maybe you believe that you don't deserve that type of life. So you'll create the situations that manifest what you truly believe about yourself. So go away and look at yourself, you know. And I had to do lots and lots of self-development, painful self-development. I had to really look at myself, my relationship with money, my relationship with validation from females, my relationship with, you know, mentoring people, my relationship with how to manage staff. Like, I didn't know any of this. You know, I was committing armed robberies age 15 while everyone was doing their GCSEs. And the key to all of my stuff has been looking at myself, you know, and learning. Like, you know, go away and learn stuff. Never stop learning. And, you know, the 11 years of sobriety, that's all I've done, is I'm relentlessly looking at me, constantly looking at the roadblocks within myself that stop me getting what I want in life.
What's one of those, so if you've come across something that you realise something that you had to work on, what mm-hmm. are then the steps to go and action that?
Yeah, so like I still see a therapist now. He's like a therapist / life coach. And I do it because anything, I like to be held accountable. So if I've got a good idea or if I've got something that I need to work on, like who am I accountable to? So you see, when you're your own boss, yeah, like who are you accountable to? You know, you're not. Are you really?
Yeah.
Like, there's no one going, why didn't you do that? Because, you know, whereas if you're an employee, you're accountable to your manager. And so for me, it's like someone to just not like say, why didn't you do that? But I know if I say something, if I bring something out into the room, it's almost like I have to take action on it. And so for me, it's like, if I know there's something in me, I have to just look at it, pull it out, explore it, and just look at it. Where does it come from? You know? And like, it's limitless. Like, honestly, the more you look, the more you find. And, you know, the more I learn, the more I realize how much I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's such a beautiful point that I'm just,
yeah.
I spoke to my dad. I've actually had my dad on the podcast, and he kind of said something very similar, and he's 77.
Oh, amazing.
he still doesn't. He said, I don't know anything.
Yeah, mate, I tell you, and that's the beauty of life, though.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of life. You know, the most interesting people, your dad sounds like a really interesting guy, man.
Yeah.
Like, they're the sort of guys who I just love connecting with, you know, them humble, honest guys who are like, yeah, I don't have it all sussed,
yeah.
You know, and, you know, I'm still learning, I'm still growing.
It's just refreshing. Like,
it is, man. Yeah. Like,
it takes that weight off of you as well.
Yeah, like, yeah. I mean, as soon as I hear someone say they've got it all figured out and they've got all the solutions to everything, I automatically just don't like them.
Yeah,
it's true. I do. I'm just like, I don't really like you, man.
Yeah. That's so true.
You know, where I meet someone who's like struggling and he's honest and vulnerable about it, I'm like, oh yeah, man, I get it. I was like, I struggle with this too, though. So let's just both, you know,
find a solution.
Find a solution and figure a way out. You know, this is what I've done. So,
beautiful.
Yeah.
So right. So this 11-year journey in sobriety has obviously taken you to some serious heights. And one of the ones I want to talk to you about, which I wasn't actually aware of until a couple of days ago when I was speaking to Ollie.
Yeah.
You were on SASU Dares Wins.
Yeah, that's right. All
right. Yeah. Can we touch on this? Because I like that show, from everything I've heard, is pretty mega experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, just talk us through a little bit about
it. Yeah, sure. So,
good experience?
It was brutal.
Yeah.
It was really brutal.
Why did you sign up for it? You just wanted to push yourself?
Yeah, it was one of them things. So the series before, I was mentoring this guy who, you know, I was mentoring this guy. He had a few problems, right? And he applied for the show and got on the show. Yeah. He had his boots, he had everything, right? And I was mentoring him, and he sort of told me about him getting onto this TV show right at the final stage. I mean, he was an actor, and he does some other bits and pieces in that TV world, right? And right at the final stage, he's got his boots and he's like, yeah, I'm going on to this show. And I was like, I don't think you should go. And he was like, why not? And I was like, well, you're like, he was like 6 months sober. I was like, I don't feel mentally you're strong enough. And I feel you could say or do something on TV now that might harm your career later on. I think maybe next series, when you're like a year sober, I think it might be better. And he really took it on board. He was like, actually, you know, I think you're probably right, you know. And the producers called me up and was like, oh, we heard your thingy's mentor. We're going to fly you out to Morocco. You can come and be, so if he needs your support, he can be there. I was like, I ain't coming to Morocco. I was like, I got life. I'm not coming sitting on the sidelines.
Yeah.
And so that put it on my radar, that show.
Did he go?
He didn't go. He pulled out. He pulled out, yeah, and someone else took his place, which I can't say who, but some other guy on that show took his place. And then the next year come round, and another friend of mine said, oh, you should apply for it. And I was like, yeah, you know what? I was doing like Spartan races and marathons and all this sort of stuff. So I was like, I'm going to throw in my app, and got called in. And then, and that was it. Yeah, got called in, done the physical, got the call the next day. We want you on. You just need to go through all these physical, psychological tests. And that was it. Yeah. Got pretty much on. And then, flew out to Chile, didn't know where we were going, but flew out there. And we knew when we got to the airport, obviously, you're boarding a flight to Santiago. And then went out there, and it was, you know, it was brutal. It was a really hard experience. The main thing that was the hardest was the lack of sleep. Yeah, it was like 1-2 hours a night. And I was there, I got halfway through the process, so I was 5 days of 1-2 hours sleep.
Savage.
Yeah, it was savage, mate. Towards the end, it was just like, you're just a zombie, really. You're just battling on through. It's just like a completely different world when you're that tired. Everything is just different.
Yeah.
Everything's a slog. Everything. Just getting out of bed is a slog.
Yeah.
So, yeah, brutal experience. But the main highlight for me, I met some great guys. Like, you build these bonds with the other recruits. It's like, it's unbelievable. Yeah. Like, they're like proper family. You know, so that was a highlight for me, meeting all them guys, you know.
Awesome. Fantastic.
Yeah, thanks.
I mean, like, so yeah, like we touched on the book, which I, by the way, I'm buzzing to read this. I'm finishing one with my next guest on the show now. He was a commander in the army in Afghanistan, which has been great. So yeah, I've got this lined up for the next one for sure.
Great.
So thank you very much.
No worries, mate.
Yeah, is there anything you could tell us about it? Like,
yeah, so yeah. Basically it's my life story. The title is Young Offender, and it touches on my childhood, and it cuts off in about 2014. And basically, when I signed the book deal with Pam McMillan, my condition was that we write the whole truth, as brutally honest as it is.
Yeah.
You know, because I didn't want some fluffed up version of my life. I was like, if we're going to go there, let's really go there. Like, let's really tell the truth. Even if there's, you know, consequences for institutions and people's lives, unfortunately, I'm just going to be brutally honest about my life. Do you know what I mean?
That's important, yeah.
And I was like, that's it. For me, that's the only way we're truly going to inspire people.
Sure.
Is if we give them the unfiltered truth. So that's what it is. It details my life. And, you know, for me, it's about inspiring someone who is struggling. And there's a lot of people struggling. I think we all need a little bit of hope at the minute. And that's what it does. It will inspire you to change. And if, you know, you're struggling and you can't make change in your own life, you can read that book and think, well, if Michael's done it, then Jesus Christ, maybe I need to stop making excuses and get on with it.
Awesome, man. Buzzy, I can't wait to read it. I'll do a little intro at the beginning about it as well for the episode. I ask this question to everyone on the show, just as a kind of way of wrapping up the episode.
Sure.
So this podcast has basically started off the back of my sort of mental health difficulties in my early 20s. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wanted to interview people so that people like myself at the time, mm-hmm. in their early 20s and 30s, who were a little bit lost for a direction, could become and be inspired. So mm-hmm. you're probably the ideal guest. Mm-hmm. So if you had like one, not word of advice, I think that could be dangerous sometimes, but almost like the number one life lesson that you have learned that sticks out to you that you could pass on.
Sure.
What would that be?
Sure. So your happiness is your responsibility, and your responsibility alone. So if you're not happy, ask yourself, is there something I'm doing that's making me unhappy that I shouldn't be doing? And is there something that makes me happy that I'm not doing? So like, what makes me happy is exercise, meditation, gratitude list, Wim Hof, breathing, yeah? Now that might not make you happy, but I know if I don't do them things and I become unhappy, then I'm responsible for my own unhappiness because I don't do things that contribute towards my happiness. So if I want to sit on the sofa watching Netflix and eating chocolate all day, but still want to be happy, then that's an unreasonable demand on myself. So I take responsibility for my own happiness, and I encourage other people to do the same. And I'm not saying that process is easy. Mm. It's not an easy process. Mm. It requires discipline. But, you know, for me, my happiness and the version that I bring into the lives of other people, the version of me, like, how am I showing up in the lives of the people that I love? Am I giving them the miserable, depressed version, or am I presenting the version that can help and support them? And the version that I present to them is my responsibility. So take responsibility of your own happiness, and you know, change is possible, and it's worth it. You're worth it, and I believe in you.
That's awesome. That's one of the best answers I've heard to that question, is thank you very much. There was one thing that you mentioned there which I wish we could spoke about earlier, with the Wim Hof method of breathing, but you know, maybe another time on another episode. But that's a fascinating thing. Lastly, where can people follow you to see all the exciting stuff that you're up to? I'm sure people will be all over it after this.
So Instagram, my social media links on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram is at Mr. Maisie, MisterMaisey. So at Mr. Maisie. Find me. If you're struggling, drop me a DM. You know, I'm pretty active on my DMs. I'll help if I can. So,
mate, thank you very, very much. It's been a real honour. I've loved every second of it. And, you know, hopefully we can do something else later down the line.
Yeah, man. Cheers. Great. Brilliant. Thank you, Hayden.
No
nice one, mate.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers, bud.